Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, once again doing this from D.C., from our Bulwark studios with Sarah Longwell, my colleague Sarah Longwell. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Charlie. Do you love our studio? Isn't it beautiful?
It actually is kind of impressive. It even has a sign up, which is,
Our original logo.
The original logo, which has morphed in many ways. So I want to talk about your piece, which has generated a huge amount of buzz about the breakup between the left and Never Trumpers, and a point that I've been trying to make, and I think that you made very, very effectively, that, you know, it's not about us, it's about you guys and whether you're blowing this whole thing. But we're sitting here in the Bulwark offices, and something very kind of extraordinary is happening that I don't fully understand. Maybe you can help me with this, okay? We've been publishing for more than 6 months. By the way, we had our six-month anniversary. I don't know if you
congrats
caught that.
To us.
Yeah. Yesterday, we published a piece that is now our all-time most read article by a substantial margin now. It is growing. And nobody's quite clear why that is. It is an open letter to Megan Rapinoe from America as told to Joel Engel. And, you know, I'm noticing two things. Somebody obviously really likes this article and is promoting it. When I've tweeted it out, the reaction that I get has been, shall we say, somewhat between negative and absolutely obscene. I mean, Charlie, go eat a bunch of bleeps, you know, that sort of thing, you know. And this piece that we have up on the Bulwark seems to have hit right on the cultural fault line on this. So I like the piece. You're less sure of this.
I'm sure. Yeah. I'm sure I don't like
the piece. Oh, okay. All right. Okay.
Or I shouldn't say I don't like. I disagree with the piece and disagree with the author. And I don't want to, you know, talk too much about something that's on our own site other than to say, number one, if this is an open letter from America, we are living in two different Americas.
Which we are.
And in my America, this was the tone is very condescending. And I would say, my guess is that a lot of the comments that are in your Twitter feed are something that I feel, which is that this is not a piece that would have been written about the men's World Cup soccer team. Now, you might say that's because when are our men, you know, ever going to win a World Cup in soccer? Probably unlikely. But that's not, I just think the idea that you would be policing the behavior of the men's soccer team to this degree is highly unlikely.
Well, okay, but I mean, think about the blowback that Colin Kaepernick got. It wasn't that, you know, I mean, he was a male athlete who took a knee. And what I was struck by about this piece was that it was very respectful. It was not, I know that people think that it was a little bit condescending, but this is the way it begins. First, let us congratulate you and your teammates on a sensational World Cup championship. You made us proud. You know us, right? The country you've represented so ably on the pitch. Because, hope this doesn't sound weird, we've kind of had some small role in your success. No question, you worked for what you've accomplished with the talents you were fortunate to be blessed with, but never forget that you had the opportunity to do so. And then it talks about, hey, you know, don't be so down on the concept of America, because we're a great country, and like you don't want to be judged by all your flaws. And it's sort of a dialogue that, you know, you're wonderful, you've done a fantastic thing, but before we get into this, you know, being embarrassed about America or hostile to it.
How did you feel when Barack Obama told the Titans of America that they didn't build this? I thought that this part especially was what I didn't like. It felt like, hey, you didn't do this on your own. You come from a big, rich country. And you're all white and privileged, and how dare you? And how dare you not recognize that we are the ones who put you here? And I thought I disagreed with that as the tone. And that Obama, you didn't build this. That is exactly how it came off to me.
Well, I do remember that very well, and I remember how condescending it felt when Obama said that. In fact, I was at a bunch of rallies where this was the theme, and I think one of the big mistakes that Republicans made was sort of like latching onto that for too long. But I do think that there is room for this pushback that, you know, that when you represent the United States of America, yes, there are flaws to it. But there's also room for real gratitude and real respect And he writes, you know, we were kind of confused the other day when you explained your refusal to sing the national anthem. We're not quite sure what upsets you. I think for detractors, you said, I would have them look hard into what I'm saying and the actions I'm doing. Maybe you don't agree with every single way that I do it, and that can be discussed. And then he writes, well, back at you. Aren't we entitled to the same benefit of the doubt? I mean,
who's telling us that we can't have that?
Can't have what?
That we can't express the benefit of the doubt. I mean, we can. We yeah. are. I mean, there's no. And this, to me, there's the thing that's happening, not just in this article, but I would say just generally as this thing falls on this cultural fault line, is somebody tweeted the other day, there needs to be a term for what a kind of wokeness on the conservative side where we really police people's patriotism. And this is sort of how it feels to me. And I would put the Kaepernick stuff in this category. Now, I personally, do I dislike it when people don't sing the national anthem? Like, personally, I don't love that. I am moved by when people are on the international stage and showing their pride in the country. That is what I prefer as a citizen. But I don't begrudge. I mean, and I actually think Megan Rapinoe's been, especially for a jock, been pretty good at expressing why she feels this way, right? That she is trying to show some social solidarity with the Colin Kaepernicks of the world and raise awareness about certain things.
And there's something very American about
that. There is something American about that.
And I appreciate it.
And I think that the fact that everybody, and so I think it is, I am now reacting not to these players, but to the reaction to the players, which is, I think, a kind of policing of their patriotism and the expression of their patriotism in a way that one side doesn't like, and a demand that they express it in a very specific way.
I get that, and I share that. And see, you and I are in a very weird sort of a space here where we're appalled by a lot of things that are going on in the country, but we still love the country. And it feels a very, this whole question of, are you proud to be an American has that political overlay. And I do understand the people who are reluctant to say that, although I do think this is also a moment to kind of double down on we are all Americans and that we ought to love the country. So you're right. I didn't feel this piece was policing her patriotism because I wasn't that offended. I think she's awesome. I really do think that she made Americans proud in that particular way. But I also think that there's room to sort of go back and forth to say that there's nothing wrong with patriotism and pride, that you can root for Megan Rapinoe and you can be a flag waver, and they're not contradictory.
They're certainly not, but I would say I'm not actually even reacting to the piece as much as to why did this piece go viral?
Yeah, okay.
What is it touching? And I think that people are looking to be angry at them, the soccer player, specifically at Rapinoe, because she is expressing a political point of view that people don't like. So just for example, one of the things that I saw, I don't know if you saw the video of this, but they were all running around with the flags on them,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
capes and on their
moment,
backs. And
yeah.
It was wonderful. But there was this moment where something happened where Megan Rapinoe and two other people were doing like a dance of some kind or some kind of movement that is clearly something that they always do. And when they were holding the flag when they started, and they accidentally drop it while they're doing it. And somebody comes right in from the back, another player, and picks it up off the ground,
right.
Sees it fall, picks it up off the ground. Mark Levin and a bunch of the folks in conservative media say Megan Rapinoe throws the flag on the ground and stomps on it. How is she?
Well,
she's so unpatriotic.
Yeah.
And then they hail the other person who came and picked up the flag as this American hero, as opposed to it being exactly what it was, which was an accident where somebody dropped something. And so to me, it is this people are not being sufficiently patriotic in a way that I demand that they be patriotic when. Actually, probably what it is like Megan Rapinoe has expressed a number of opinions that conservatives don't like, and saying she wouldn't go to the White House, which, you know, look, I'm here to say, hey, you should probably win before you start declining invitations to the White House. I agree with that. I get that. But it's sort of like when we were talking about the fourth.
I have to admit, I kind of admired the calling the shot thing. That did not bother me at all.
No,
I thought,
it was amazing.
You know what? You people have put this pressure on yourself, and you lived up to it. I mean, that's part of it. Is like you call your shot. The whole world is looking at you. You know the daggers are out, and then you just stroke it in there.
Man, you tell me. I watched Megan Rapinoe, and I'm sitting there being like, you boxed yourself in, friend. Yeah. Like you raised the stakes on this so high, and then she clenches her jaw. She looks at it calmly, walks up, and just like taps it in like it's nothing. Like, if that's not an exciting, it's just a moment to be excited.
Oh, so actually, I think what you're describing, though, is why people were so sensitive there, because the reaction, as I mentioned, huge readership, but also huge blowback on social media. And I think a lot of the blowback is this sense of we don't want to be beating up on them. We don't want to do these kinds of things that you just described. I don't think this piece by Joel Engel really does that, but I understand that we're at a point where everybody's kind of on a hair trigger. You know, that it is hard to be in that space where you go, I love everything that you've done, and now I want to talk to you about your country and have this sort of thing. But I do take your point. Okay, I also wanted to have you in to talk about this piece that you had earlier in the week, The Breakup, because this all happened kind of fast, didn't it? It felt like it was 2 weeks. Everything was never Trumpers had that strange new respect. And then suddenly you had the Democratic debate and never Trumpers raised their hands tentatively at first and said, hey, you guys, you understand that if you come out for things like taking away people's private health insurance, if you come out, you know, you're even talking about gun confiscation or a variety of other things, you're going to be losing a lot of winnable voters. And then, of course, we got all this, well, you never Trumpers, why don't you clean up your own house? You blew it. You built all of this. We don't need you people. We can win this election without you. And you describe this as the breakup.
Yes. And I think what we have here is a failure to communicate.
Yeah.
Not necessarily irreconcilable differences, because this is the idea. They seem to think that what we're saying is we demand that Democrats nominate a conservative. Eugene Robinson in The Washington Post had a whole article that was incredibly condescending that said something like, you know, newsflash, guys, the Democrats are going to nominate a Democrat. And what we are saying, we never Trumpers are saying, is not, hey, can you nominate our favorite person? We are saying, hey, can you please nominate somebody who is going to win Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, maybe Florida, maybe Arizona, because this is, it's like people forget that the Electoral College exists. And I know that people are mad that it exists, but it ain't going away between now and Election Day. We have to grapple with the fact that.
So this election is not going to be decided in Berkeley.
It is not going to. People are like, this is to me the most amazing thing. We've got to turn out our base. Okay. We need a candidate who's really going to turn out our base. My response is, you have a candidate who is going to really turn out your base. That is Donald J. Trump, okay? Your base is excited. Your base is just itching to vote. The question is, who is going to pick up independent and swing voters in these Midwestern states? And those are the people you have to get. And those people, they ran to Democrats in 2018. You're lucky. By narrow margins, though. Narrow margins.
And those Democrats were elected in places like Texas and Oklahoma and Orange County, California, and they ran as centrist or center-left candidates, and yet everybody seems to think it's the AOC primary.
The idea that people keep saying this to me on Twitter, like, well, we ran really progressive candidates. And no, you didn't. Like, the people who won in Michigan 8 or Michigan 11 or Abigail Spanberger in Virginia, the Virginia 7, these were a lot of them like CIA analysts, military people who ran on incredibly pragmatic platforms in their state, ran on local issues, ran on protecting pre-existing conditions and being a constitutional check on Trump. They did not run on eliminating private health insurance or on other issues that poll very low with the average American.
Right. They wouldn't have won those seats. So, and again, Gene Robinson's a good guy, kind of a friend. But when he says that we're saying, you know, nominate some mealy mouthed Republican light. No, we want you to nominate Democrats that actually can win elections. And Democrats do know how to do that, at least in some context.
In some context. And I think this is the question that I sort of am raising in my piece is, like, do you believe that Trump is an existential threat? Because for the last 2 years, why are we never Trumpers? We are never Trumpers because we do believe that no matter how many judges, no matter how many tax cuts, there aren't enough of them in the world to justify the dangers that Trump presents to norms.
Did you see who tweeted you out that sentence?
Yeah.
James Comey. Said you nailed it in one sentence.
Yes, I appreciated that. My mentions are just filled with people yelling, traitor, and you're going to jail. I keep realizing that's not meant for me. So yes, I got a big retweet from James Comey. Thank you for the 400 new followers, James Comey.
Really, that's pretty. That is pretty good. No, but you're exactly right on this, though. That there are, every one of these issues is a winner, if you don't turn it into a loser. And I thought that was the point that you made here. Most Americans support access to abortion first 20 weeks. I don't, but that most Americans do. They want you to do something on climate change. They want permanent status for, you know, DACA recipients. You know, they want a pathway for citizenship. They want improved health care. What they don't want is, you know, eliminating private insurance, late-term abortions, the Green New Deal, open borders, and free health care for illegal immigrants. And that's not just your opinion. That's what the polls are saying in a very loud voice.
It is neither my opinion nor is it a value judgment on, like, my personal value judgment on the progressive agenda. It is merely an empirical. There is a progressive agenda that is broadly popular that they could have for the taking that involves a pathway to citizenship for illegal immigrants, that involves action on climate change, that involves modest reforms to gun control. And then there's if you drag it out, you know, to the extremes, then there's a very unpopular progressive agenda that doesn't have widespread support. And for some reason, a lot of the front runners are running on the latter. And people some people were pushing back on this idea, saying, oh, well, this isn't, you know, these candidates aren't extreme at all. These aren't far left candidates. I mean, I just couldn't disagree more when you start talking about eliminating private health insurance. And so forget what my argument would be about providing health care to people who are here, who are undocumented. The fact is that polls incredibly poorly. But there are immigration platforms you could run on that are popular that would get you a long way to helping people who are here illegally and giving status to DACA recipients. But instead of talking about that, what are we talking? Where are we going to talk? We're talking about busing. We're talking about free health care. It's like political malpractice, and I don't understand it.
Well, and also, you know, I think unfortunate for the Democrats, Kamala Harris got cover for her debate performance. She had a terrible gaffe where she, quote unquote, misunderstood the question about taking away people's private health insurance. I'm not sure they would have been so charitable to Joe Biden if he had misheard the question. And then bringing up involuntary school busing, which, number one, is probably as textbook a case of bad public policy as you can get, but also toxically unpopular. I was thinking about these things the other day. You know, went out to some friend's house in rural Wisconsin, and there are people who would not disagree with me about Donald Trump, I don't think, in any particular way. And yet I think they're going to vote for Donald Trump next year because of the Democrats, because all of the, to a certain extent, they've, you know, we all know what the dangers of Donald Trump are, or they think they do, and they're sort of out there. Whereas they're looking at Democrats, massive tax increases, massive deficit spending, the abolition of private health insurance. They don't support Donald Trump on the border, but they also don't want open borders. And it was offensive to them, you know, to see all those hands go up about you know, free health care for the illegal immigrants. And the gun issue and the abortion issue may not play with the elites, but they play really. They play in those areas that I do think the Democrats have to win. Even the discussion of, you know, mandatory gun buybacks. It was Eric Swalwell. That's not going to happen.
And he's out.
But, I mean, people are not going to vote to blow up their 401ks, lose their private health insurance, and have the government confiscate their guns because they, even if they despise Donald Trump. And I mean, that's part of the argument. I'm not endorsing that point of view. It's like, people, you know, do you want to win this election or do you not want to win this election?
Well, in some ways, that's the difference, right, is we actually talk to Republican voters. I mean, this is why, look, fine, people don't want to listen to Never Trumpers. I get it. But we do actually live outside of a blue bubble. So in some ways, we talk to these voters who we know don't like Donald Trump, but say why they're going to vote for him. We hear that all the time. And it does come down in some ways to a devil you know versus devil
right.
You don't.
Exactly.
And when you have an economy that is rock solid, and he's got a $100 million war chest. I mean, I keep seeing people say things like, well, you know, a bag of flour could beat Donald Trump at this point. This is one of those, and I know I've said this before, so I don't want to belabor it too much, but there's a hubris there where it's like people forget how they felt at 9 a.m. on November 8th, 2016, And then at 9 p.m. on November 8th, 2016, when they were so sure they were going to win, to watching it all slip away. Like, you have to remember that feeling and know that it can happen again, because it absolutely
can happen again. And I was following a friend of ours. You know, I'm not gonna call him out, but on Twitter, who was saying that, you know, this election should be decided on character. That none of the economic issues, none of these other issues should matter. People should vote on character, and I agree with him. And I mean, I really do. I do agree with him. I take his point, but that's not the way voters vote necessarily. They vote their pocketbook. They vote their values. If they are scared that something's going to happen to them, and I do think that this election will be decided by which party looks like it's going to take away something in terms of health care. If the Democrats look like they're going to take away your private health care, they're going to lose this election. If, on the other hand, the Republicans somehow win that lawsuit and it looks like they're going to take away all of the Obamacare benefits there, they're going to lose the election. So, I mean, these things, there are, and I do think that there are voters who are persuadable. And I think you saw that in 2018, but a lot of the folks who are being critical of our warnings are not really taking the lessons of 2018 to heart. They've created their own narrative in their heads.
I think that's true. I mean, because the lesson, one of the great lessons of 2018 was that if you talk about what the Republicans are going to do, like taking away pre-existing condition coverage, you win. And I just cannot understand how in 2 years the Democrats have gone from, hey, we're going to protect pre-existing conditions, we're going to improve Obamacare. I mean, it took a decade for Obamacare to get popular with, you know, a majority of popular support, but now they've got it. And so why not focus on taking this thing that is relatively popular and saying, talking about how they're going to improve it and not let Republicans dismantle it and force the Republicans to fight on that territory? I just, it's like they want to hand them these issues that they, I mean, remember in 2000, how many seats did the Democrats lose? 60.
Yeah.
Because of Obamacare. Okay, healthcare drives, it absolutely drives elections, and the Democrats are putting themselves, and people keep saying, oh, you know, it's not all the Democrats, you're just taking the most radical positions. Okay, well, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are two of the four front runners, and they both believe in eliminating private health insurance. And Kamala Harris, it's been difficult to pin her down on this, because sometimes she says she's for eliminating private insurance, and then other times she backs off of it, which means she's probably not so far off from it.
Well, and given her stated willingness to use executive orders, I mean, it is interesting how the Democrats are kind of ramping it up, saying, yes, we hate what Donald Trump is doing, but you know what? We're going to do the same sorts of things. We're going to declare, Bernie Sanders is saying, I'm going to declare an emergency on the climate. Kamala Harris saying she'll give Congress 100 days to do something on guns. If they don't do it, she'll act by executive order. This is the sort of thing that, you know, you have the blowback. Now, in your piece, you speculated, you do wonder if this entire relationship between the Democrats and Never Trumpers was doomed from the start. I love this line. Never Trumpers are politically homeless today, roaming around Reagan 35X like a pack of hobos. That's a very inside Washington thing. It's the worst gate at Reagan.
It's the worst
gate
at Reagan.
All because we weren't willing to trade a political agenda we more or less agreed with for a morally, intellectually, and temperamentally unfit president. And progressives are saying the same thing, right? They're saying, you know, this is an existential threat to our country, but they're not willing.
But let's roll it. But we really want single payer. So let's roll the dice on somebody who might not be able to beat him.
Yeah, somebody as woke as possible.
This is what I can't fathom. Because if you believe that he is this dangerous existential threat, then you go. And I feel like a lot of Democratic voters are there. They're there. They believe electability is their number one issue. Who can win? And so, but I don't understand then why, you know, of the 24 candidates, 19 of them have decided to like win the woke Olympics, because that's just not where the majority of Democratic voters are. And I cannot believe, Democrats have always told me this. They're always like, oh, don't underestimate Democrats' ability to snatch defeat right from the jaws of victory. And I am watching it like a slow motion car accident right now. And tell me what you think about this, because this is something that I've seen come up a lot. Is this idea that, like, well, look, it's a Democratic primary. Right. You know, they're gonna be, say, a bunch of lefty things, but then they're gonna tack to the center. But I would say it is pretty hard to tack on eliminating private health care. What do you think?
No, I agree with you. In fact, we were having this conversation before. You know, the conventional wisdom is don't worry about it. It's a Democratic primary. Of course, they move left. In the general election, they will all tack to the center. And I, you know, because that's what you've done in the past. I don't know whether you can do that anymore. I mean, they have the pictures and the videos of them raising their hands. on a variety of issues. So I do think it's going to be very, very difficult. And the issues that you just described, because they fit the Trump playbook so perfectly. If you're sitting in the White House and you're coming up with this laboratory model of who you want to run against, it's like just watch the debates because they're taking these positions. So how are they? Now, the Green New Deal, can they basically say, well, that's just aspirational and what I really want is this? Maybe. But by the time you get to that convention, there's going to be this indelible image of the Democrats as being this radical party out there that's going to think it's going to be hard. It's going to be hard for them to move back from. So I'm not as confident as some of these folks are. Anyway, the Eugene Robinsons, you know, who basically say, don't worry about anything. We do this stuff. But the problem is the country's watching you. They're looking over your shoulder and seeing what you're saying.
I don't see being able to walk back from it. So sometimes people do this, right? It's like everybody recognizes that Donald Trump has like blown up a lot of political rules, but they seem to apply one prism for Donald Trump and then one entirely different prism for everybody else. And they think that the old rules still apply to everybody else. And I'm not sure that's true. I mean, Donald Trump didn't tack to the center when he was running in the Republican primary. He tacked all over the place. But nobody, like everybody was just like, fine for Donald Trump. I don't think these Democrats are going to either one necessarily just tack to the center because that's the old political adage, nor do I think that they'll get away with it, changing their position the way that you might have been able to do, you know, a couple cycles ago.
Yeah, I know that I'm going to be misunderstood and taken out of context about what I'm about to say here, but people need to understand, I do think that the case against Trump is much stronger than it was in 2016. The case for Trump is also much stronger among a lot of these voters because the economy is strong. People cannot ignore that. Yes, there are demographic changes, but they may not kick in time for this election. And so you have somebody who's basically coming in saying, you know, I have presided over peace and prosperity. Yes, you've had a lot of really obnoxious tweets. Yes, you've had the racism, you know, you have the corruption, you have all of this stuff. But your life is better. And the other side will put all of that at risk. A lot of the things that we were really concerned about what was going to happen. I mean, I was asked at one point, what are you most afraid of a Trump presidency? What happened to Trump presidency? And my answer was thermonuclear war. Well, that didn't happen. You know, he hasn't nominated crazy people to the bench. He hasn't tanked the economy. He may yet with the tariffs. He may yet with, you know, the national debt and the deficit, but he hasn't. So the argument among those swing voters, the people who voted for Trump, who provided him that 77,000 vote margin in those swing states, they're not breaking loose.
No, and they're not paying attention to the outrages that we are. Like, we may think it is terrible the way that Trump is juicing the economy by keeping his, you know, thumb on the Fed. But the average person, all they know is that interest rates are low and the economy continues to do well. And I guess Democrats can try to run and say, no, the economy is actually bad for you. You're working three jobs. And that may be true of some people. That may be some people's I actually don't know whose experience, how many people for whom that is their experience. But I do know that broadly, the president is getting high marks on this economy, even as he gets low marks for leadership. James Carville. It is the economy, stupid. People are not paying that much attention to the daily outrages, but they know whether or not their life is marginally better. And they will be reticent to change horses in that scenario.
Okay, are we missing something here? Because, okay. So you've written your piece. I've written my piece. David Brooks is out there. Bret Stephens is out there. Max Boot has written this piece. I mean, we've all never Trumpers. And of course, you know, it's the blowback. Why should we listen to Never Trumpers? But shouldn't this be coming from Democrats? Where are the Democratic op-ed pieces making this point? Now, this morning I did hear a soundbite from Amy Klobuchar, who was very adamant that we are not going to be the party that will take away 80 million, you know, the health insurance from 80 million Americans. I thought, okay, that's good. Are we just not listening to that? Have they been drowned out? But I mean, shouldn't there be as many op-ed pieces from centrist Democrats making the point that you're making?
Yeah, I think there's some. And I quote Jonathan Chait in my piece, who did have one that I thought was really excellent.
Surprising.
And clear-eyed. Yeah, and I think, you know, the third way folks are out there fighting the good fight against Bernie. But I don't think that it is, I don't hear a groundswell of opposition. And part of it is that, like, who are they supposed to, who are the moderate standard bearers, who are the front runners, right? It's sort of Biden.
Biden or who?
And I mean, Buttigieg is like, he's not an actual centrist by any stretch of the imagination. He is tonally moderate.
Yeah, he reads.
He's totally
centrist, although he's not.
He's not.
Right, right.
And so if you are somebody who wants to go out and say demand moderation, you don't necessarily have that many candidates you can look to. I mean, it is Elizabeth Warren's not going to be more moderate. Bernie Sanders isn't going to be more moderate. They are who they are. I mean, Kamala Harris is probably your best bet. But the problem for her is she's trying to overcome the notion that she was a prosecutor and, you know, that she's the Republican-ish candidate in there, which is crazy. Sounds crazy to us. But I think that, so she's running hard to the left too. I mean, just think about every time AOC, like the Green New Deal, puts something out, people run to endorse that thing. It's wild.
You know, speaking of AOC, and this feels old by now, but, you know, why are people paying as much attention? And I would think that you can tell that Nancy Pelosi is asking that question. Can you imagine what Nancy Pelosi says behind closed doors about AOC, given what she's saying out front? But it's got to be immensely frustrating, because you and I were just talking about, you know, the freshman class of Democrats, how they are generally relatively moderate, relatively centrist, and yet you would think there's only four members of the House, and they are all radical progressives. But AOC just keeps spouting off, saying things. It shows that she hasn't thought things through. She is not thoughtful. She is not accurate. She is not talk about somebody who's out over their skis on a regular basis. So there is a sort of a Trumpian quality of just watching the shambolic nature of it. But Democrats, you know, they tell us, well, you know, clean up your own house. You need to deal with that problem. I don't know how you do it either.
Well, yeah, just, I mean, we see that equivalency. I make this equivalency a lot, that AOC,
that.
No, nobody is interested in hearing that. And frankly, I just to go back a little bit to the breakup and trying to understand why the Democrats are so mad at us for what we're saying. I think in some ways they view our criticism as essentially reaching a lot of these swing voters, and that we are compounding the message.
You're not helping.
Yeah, well, it's exactly like we're compounding the message that the Dems have gone too far left, and that is not going to serve the purpose of defeating Donald Trump. And I think this is the problem, right, is that they would like us to defeat Donald Trump, you know, their way. And we have this in common, right? We also would very much like to defeat Donald Trump with one of their candidates, not with somebody who's conservative, not with somebody who's like us. We know that it's probably going to be a Democrat who's going to have to take him down. We just want someone who can get the job done. And we are telling them right now, where your people are isn't going
to
do
if,
it.
If they don't hear it from us, they're going to hear it from the $1 billion that Donald Trump is about to dump on their heads. So
already
it's
dumping it on their heads. They're beating each other up over busing. And he's meanwhile got $100 million war chest that he's already running in three states on digital ads all day long for every crazy thing they say.
I don't know. I try to remain hopeful, because every once in a while you step away from this, the red bubble and the blue bubble, and you step away from Twitter and you find out that people actually are more fundamentally decent, have more common sense, and you hope that will come up, that there's just some sort of a sane candidate. But it's just it's a long hot summer.
It's a long hot summer. And just to go back to where we started, this is the one thing. So I'll call myself a World Cup super fan, in the sense that it's a sport that I watch every 4 years, when for about the last four games, right? Which to me is the most sports that I watch at all. But like the idea that it is so politicized.
Everything
is so
July
politicized.
4th, soccer.
That you can't just sort of root for the home team, be proud of being an American, them be proud of being Americans, we be proud of them, and have it not all be ultimately about Donald Trump, is tough, man.
Yeah, we just got to get through this period. You know, that somebody was saying, I had a conversation with a conservative yesterday, and who was saying, actually much more conservative than I am, was saying, well, so what happens after Trump leaves? Will we be able to have this debate? And it's like, I think when Trump leaves, everything does change. Because once you take out that cult of personality, then we can actually begin to discuss issues again without this weird overlay that just like seeps into every crack and crevice of our lives.
This is why I'm such an Amy Klobuchar fan. I don't care that she is a boring Midwestern woman. Like, all I want is somebody who does not live in our heads 24/7. That you just don't have to, that we can debate other things, that we can go back to having old fights over marginal tax rates or the
salad with a fork.
Yeah. she ate it with a comb, I think.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry, what a fork? I was thinking
they
comb.
They forgot the fork. Yeah, yeah, so she ate it with the comb.
Yeah, I mean, I eat salad with a fork. See, it's been a long day. I'm already stressed out by all of this. Thank you, Sarah Longwell, for joining me. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.